From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. A new special edition DVD of the 1986 film Blue Velvet is coming out Tuesday. It includes new interviews with the cast and deleted scenes. On today's Fresh Air, interviews with Blue Velvet stars Dennis Hopper and Isabella Rossellini and director David Lynch. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews The Eminem Show, and guest film critic Armand White reviews the new thriller about nuclear terrorism, The Sum of All Fears. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The State Department says the 60,000 Americans living in India should consider leaving because of the growing threat of war between India and Pakistan. Spokesman Richard Boucher said the fact that both nations have nuclear weapons is part of the reason for concern.
For those of us in the United States and Russia and other nuclear-capable countries who have thought about this for many years, perhaps we understand this better. But it's very clear to us that even contemplating the use of nuclear weapons should be out of the question.
The State Department also recommended that all non-essential U.S. diplomatic personnel and their families leave, but did not order them to do so. Federal prosecutors and lawyers for John Walker Lind were in court today trying to resolve a dispute about who will testify in an important hearing. The hearing will decide whether Lind's statements to interrogators should be thrown out. NPR's Greg Allen reports.
Lind's lawyers and federal prosecutors agree that 30 government personnel, mostly members of the military, can be subpoenaed by the defense. Prosecutors oppose subpoenas for 7 people the defense wants to talk to. Lind's attorneys believe the witnesses will support their contention that their client was mistreated by authorities, that he was wounded and kept in a metal shipping container, often bound to a cot when he was interrogated. The government strongly denies Lind was mistreated. At a hearing in July, Lind's lawyers will argue that any statements their client made to authorities were coerced and are not admissible at trial. Among those the defense wants to subpoena are naval officers who confiscated and destroyed unauthorized photos taken by sailors of Lind while he was being held aboard the USS Peleliu, photos the defense believes showed Lind when he was unable to walk and was put on an IV because of dehydration. Greg Allen, NPR News, Washington.
California's governor is asking President Bush to let the federal government buy up offshore oil drilling rights off the California coast, as the president has proposed doing in Florida. NPR's Andy Bowers reports.
Earlier this week, the president proposed spending more than $200 million of federal money to buy out private oil and gas drilling rights in the Everglades and off the Florida coast. The president's brother, Governor Jeb Bush of Florida, acknowledged the move would likely help his reelection bid. But California politicians have reacted angrily since the Bush administration has actually taken legal steps to protect similar oil company leases off the Santa Barbara coast. Now, California Governor Gray Davis has formally written to the president asking that he also buy out the California drilling rights. Davis asked Mr. Bush to demonstrate that he is, quote, equally concerned with the beauty and fragility of California's Pacific coast as you are with Florida's Gulf Coast resources. But the Interior Department contends the two cases are at different stages of litigation. Andy Bowers, NPR News, Los Angeles.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials gained 13 points to close at 9,925 in heavy trading. For the week, the Dow was down 179 points. The Nasdaq lost 16 points today. This is NPR News. A panel of federal judges in Philadelphia has overturned a federal law that would have required public libraries to install internet filtering software designed to block pornography from their computers. The panel ruled that the Children's Internet Protection Act would violate the First Amendment. The decision said that filtering software could also block access to sites that contain speech that's protected by the Constitution. Tonight, the New Jersey Nets and Sacramento Kings could become the surprising finalists for the National Basketball Association Championship. If both teams win their playoff games, they'll move on to the finals and leave behind two storied franchises. NPR's Tom Goldman reports.
New Jersey and Sacramento lead their respective playoff series 3-2. A fourth win sends them into uncharted territory to play for an NBA title. Well, almost uncharted. While the Nets haven't won a championship, the Kings technically have, in 1951, when the franchise was based in Rochester. The two teams' current opponents, the Boston Celtics and Los Angeles Lakers, share 29 NBA titles, but past history has meant nothing, as the Nets have outplayed the Celtics, and the Kings have made the defending champion Lakers and their dynamic duo of Kobe Bryant and Shaquille O'Neal look ordinary. Once again, Nets point guard Jason Kidd will try to do a bit of everything, scoring, passing, rebounding, in order to shut down Boston one more time. The Kings, behind their emerging star guard Mike Bibby, will try to finish off the Lakers. Tom Goldman, NPR News.
The productivity of American workers rose sharply during the first quarter, largely because layoffs at many businesses left fewer employees to do more work. Workers' output per hour of work rose by 8.4%. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Geraldine R. Dodge Foundation, supporting educational, cultural, and environmental initiatives to make our world more livable. On the web at grdodge.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The 1986 film Blue Velvet will be out next week on a new special edition DVD featuring deleted scenes and new interviews. Today we'll hear from the director, David Lynch, and two stars of the film, Isabella Rossellini and Dennis Hopper.
All right. We're giving our neighbor a joyride. Let's get on with it. Anyone want to go on a joyride with us? How about you?
Dennis Hopper made his comeback in Blue Velvet, confirming that he was brilliant at acting crazy. Just a few years before Hopper's comeback, he was institutionalized, paranoid, and totally disoriented from years of drugs and booze. Hopper started acting in movies when he was a teenager and had a small part in Rebel Without a Cause. In 1969, he became famous for directing and co-starring in the counterculture road movie Easy Rider. More recently, he played the Serbian terrorist Viktor Drazen in the TV series 24. We're going to hear an excerpt of my 1990 interview with Hopper. We talked first about Blue Velvet. He won a Best Supporting Actor Award from the National Society of Film Critics for his performance. The Society also gave Blue Velvet awards for Best Film, Best Director, and Best Achievement in Cinematography. Blue Velvet is set in what appears to be an idyllic small town, until a young man, played by Kyle MacLachlan, finds a severed ear in the grass. His search for the story behind the ear leads him to some strange people, including Hopper's character, Frank Booth. Frank is sadistic and crazy, but when Hopper read the script, he said to David Lynch, "I am Frank."
I didn't have a problem with Frank. I just understood him. And I called David. I'd never met David, and he'd given me the part, and I called him. He was down in North Carolina already. They'd begun filming. And I said, "You don't have to worry about this. I am Frank. I really understand this role." So he got off the phone. He told Isabella and Kyle MacLachlan and Laura that, he said, "My God, I just got off the phone with Dennis Hopper," and he said he was Frank. He said, "That may be great for the movie, but how are we going to have lunch with him?" But I really meant that I understood the role. And I do understand Frank. You know, I've known Frank. I've known a lot of guys like Frank.
Did you think that you were like Frank at some point in your life?
Well, I understood his sexual obsession, you know. And I, even though David wrote it as the stuff that he was sniffing as helium, I had always thought of it as some sort of drug, you know, like an amyl nitrate or a nitric oxide. And I asked David if it would be all right to play it that way. He had helium on the set, and all helium does, it doesn't disorient your mind. All it does is make you sound like Daffy Duck. So I tried it, and I said, "David, I'm really aware. I'm just hearing my voice. I'm not, you know, able to act." I said, "I want something. Couldn't I try to use something that, like, disoriented my mind?" And he said, "What?" And I said, "Well, watch this. I'd do a sense memory of an amyl nitrate, nitric oxide or something." He said, "What are those things?" I said, "Just watch." So anyway, he liked what he saw. And I said, "If you want to dub that voice in the helium voice in later, we could do that." And he said, "No, I don't think it'll be necessary." Anyway, we didn't dub it in later, and it did work. But, you know, since then, I started thinking how strange it would be if I'd used that helium voice and not had it disorient my mind. What a strange character he had actually written, even more stranger than my portrayal of Frank.
Yeah, I see what you mean.
You know, it'd just been this guy who takes this, that does this mask and gets this weird voice and then does all those things and nothing else happens to him. It'd be very bizarre. But anyway, because when I read it, I thought of it that way, of the drug kind of drug-crazed guy and the sexual kind of strange appetite that he had. I could identify with those things.
Do you like roles with the kind of intensity that your performance has on the character of Frank?
Well, like, you know, I think that probably of all the work that I've done, Frank is probably the flashiest role I ever had.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I like it on that level. Yeah.
Your first movie role was in Rebel Without a Cause. You were, I think, 18 years old. Did the movie help give you a sense of teenagers being their own culture and their own misunderstood culture? Were you already feeling that way?
When I went on that picture, I saw James Dean for the first time act, and at that point, all I was concerned about was being an actor. I wasn't concerned about, like, you know, whether people were juvenile delinquents or not. I had sort of come out of that, out of San Diego and Tijuana and that kind of area, but I was interested in acting, and I saw James Dean act, and I basically threw Rebel Without a Cause, I was just trying to figure out what he was doing because I thought I was the best young actor at that time in the world, and I suddenly ran into this guy who was some years older than me, but he was doing work that I was so far over my head, I actually grabbed him on the Chickie Run and threw him into a car and said, "What are you doing? You got to teach me what you're doing."
So what did he teach you?
He wanted to know what my motivation was for wanting to act. Yeah. And he asked me if I'd had a problem with my parents, that if I had actually hated my parents, and that that was part of the drive that I had to want to become an actor. And I said that actually I had felt that. And he said, well, that's what he felt also, and that that his mother died when he was very young, and he used to go to her grave and cry on her grave and say, "Mother, why have you left me? Why have you left me?" And that turned into, I'm going to be someone. And that was the drive that he had brought into his acting, which I described the same sort of feelings that I was misunderstood by my parents, and that I had that feeling when they came to the theater that I was going to show them. And it was like, you know, I'm going to show you, I'm going to be something, I'm going to be an actor. So this drive, this confused kind of drive and wanting to put it into other people's other parts and other things, and these feelings to use them in some sort of imaginary given circumstance became the key for acting. But anyway, he said you must learn how to not worry about the emotions, but you must learn how to do things and not show them. You must learn how to smoke a cigarette and just not act smoking the cigarette. You must learn how to drink a drink, not act drinking the drink. And if somebody knocks on the door, you go and answer the door. Then you see they have a gun in their hand. Then you react to the gun and so on. So basically, it's like don't indicate, but like do something and don't show it. And moment-to-moment reality. Never anticipate what the next moment's going to hold. When he died, it just destroyed me because I totally had this belief in destiny and how people are destined, to be to fulfill their destiny, you know. And I just couldn't understand why James Dean had died so young. He wanted to direct movies. He had only been in three movies, and it just destroyed my whole concept of destiny, life, and that kind of thing for years. I mean, probably still till this day, it still bothers me. I miss him. I wish I'd have seen his work.
Dennis Hopper, recorded in 1990. Coming up, another star of Blue Velvet, Isabella Rossellini. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
A special edition DVD of Blue Velvet will be released next week. We're featuring interviews with some of the people behind the film. Isabella Rossellini knows that she means different things to different people. She says, to people in their 30s and 40s, she's the star of Blue Velvet. To people 60 and over, she's the daughter of movie star Ingrid Bergman. To film scholars, she's the daughter of Italian director Roberto Rossellini. Women of different generations know her as the former model for Lancôme Cosmetics. Isabella Rossellini wrote about those different facets of her life in her memoir, Some of Me. I spoke with her in 1997 when it was published.
I want to ask you about Blue Velvet. You were so wonderful in that film.
Thank you.
You played a nightclub singer who's exotic and mesmerizing, but is in a weird and abusive relationship with a psycho played by Dennis Hopper.
Yes.
How did you get the part, and what interested you in this part?
To me, it was the only time that I could portray a battered woman and a Stockholm syndrome, where it's very hard for a victim to recognize that they're a victim. Generally, a victim feels guilty, and does anything to please the person who's torturing them. And it's an absolute strange twist that our mind gives us. And you know, it is a recognized syndrome on kidnapped people or raped victims. And I thought it was quite interesting to play that part, and that what appealed me for the role. It was a wonderful way to portray sexuality and the darkness of it. And I played a femme fatale that was femme fatale just because she was kind of beautiful and she was singing and she had the features of somebody beautiful, but yet she was completely destroyed inside. And that was a pretty good role, you know. Most of the time, the femme fatales are portrayed as women who know exactly what they want and completely. And sex is portrayed as something that you go out there and choose for yourself. Well, we know that the reality is often we just have to. It just happens to us, and then we don't know what to do with it, what to make of it.
I'd like to play an excerpt of a scene that you had with a young man played by Kyle MacLachlan. And then in this scene, he's trying to solve the mystery of who you are and who Frank, the Dennis Hopper character, is. In this scene, you're being very seductive. You're trying to seduce him.
Do you like the way I feel?
Yes.
Feel me.
Hit me! Hit me! Hit me!
Isabella Rossellini, did you understand why this character asks to be hit?
Yes, I do, because I once was beaten, and I remembered when I played that part, and I had to say that line, beat me, I said, why would this woman want to be beaten? And then I remember that the time that it happened to me that I was beaten, the first blow to my head, and you just see little stars, exactly like Donald Duck. And there was a sense of bewilderment, and you don't know where you are. But I wasn't panicked. I wasn't anything. I just was bewildered. A strange feeling. And I thought that this woman, who had so many torments in her mind, became the victim of the abuse that she... because she was raped and beaten by the character of Dennis Hopper, so that when she did get the first blow, the first punch, she would see the star, and her tormented thoughts could stop. And that's why she asked to be beaten.
Oh, what an interesting way of looking at it. Who beat you?
I don't want to give the details of all that. I don't want to start, you know, being oh, poor me. It happened, but I'm fine now.
Fine, okay. What do you do when you're shooting the scenes with Dennis Hopper, say the scenes where he's raping you and inhaling this weird in this weird gas that he inhales that turns him on? What do you do in a scene like that to break the tension?
Well, Dennis was wonderful. You know, that was the first scene I have done in the film. I just came. The film had started, I think, a week or two. And we came in, and David said, you know, we're going to start with that scene, because that scene otherwise we'll always be thinking about it. We'll always be worrying about it. So we'll do it on the first day so we get it over with. And I couldn't believe that I had to be in front of Dennis Hopper naked and say all this weird thing. I was agonizing. And I asked, I left a little message to Dennis' room saying, can I have breakfast with you? I've never met the man. Just to have to get to know him a little bit. And he came very annoyed. But that, you know, what do you want? To become friends to do that? And he was right. You know, you are acting. You don't have to be friends. But then Dennis and David were so wonderfully protective of me and so wonderfully comical too, that they really released attention, and it was wonderful to work with them.
There's a scene in the movie where you're wandering around the street naked. Tell me about that scene and what you wanted your body to look at. It's not a vanity scene.
No, not at all. I mean, it's not at all. David Lynch told me that when he was a child, coming back from school, he saw a naked woman walking in the street. And instead of getting aroused or excited at that sight, he started to cry. It terrified him. And he wanted to convey the same terror. He wanted Dorothy to walk in the street of Wilmington, where we shot the film, naked, and convey the same sense of terror instead of the sense of sex appeal. And when he was talking to me, there was a photo of Nick Ott that I remembered. And it was a photo of a young girl in Vietnam. She has been a victim of Nepal attack, and her clothes have been completely torn off her body, and she has skin hanging. And she's completely naked, and she walks in the street with the arms outstretched, and it's such a helpless gesture. And I couldn't think of anything else. That is absolute helpless gesture and walking like that. If I would have walked covering my breast or covering myself, it meant that Dorothy still had some sense of pride, still had something in her to protect her. That woman had to have lost everything, and so she had to walk completely exposed, just saying, help me. And that photo is the photo. I took the gesture from that photo and used it. And I hope that I conveyed the same sense of despair. I wanted to be like raw meat. You know, my nudity, it was like raw meat, like a butcher, like walking in a butcher and see a cow hanging, you know, a quarter of a cow hanging. That was the thing that I wanted to convey.
Seems to me you really have a very analytical approach to acting. No, I mean that you really kind of think it through on many levels.
Well, I do, you know, I don't know. I can't tell. But this is the way I do it. I don't know if it is more or less analytical than others.
One of the things that I learned about from your new book, Some of Me, is that when you were young, you had scoliosis, a curvature of the spine, and yours was pretty severe.
Yes.
So you had surgery in which, 13 vertebrae were fused?
Exactly.
Do I have that right? And you were in a body cast for, about 6 months?
For about 2 years.
2 years, my goodness.
Yes, but I think the hardest part of it was the pain. The pain, everything else you could deal with. You know, I was a teenager and I was embarrassed to have a body cast. I was embarrassed to be labeled deformed, but because that's what the scoliosis is. But those all seem to be not major problem. Really, the great problem is great physical pain. That is really hard. And I don't have any solution for it. I'm glad that I'm over it.
How long did the pain last?
The pain lasts for periods, depending on the operation. And now they don't do that procedures anymore. But at the time I did my operation, they used bone from my leg to fuse my vertebra so that there would be no problem of rejection. But in order for the bone to fuse together, I had to be immobilized for 6 months, and then also had cast. The operation was very painful. The stretching and the correction of the spine, which is now done while you're asleep and with these rods, metal rods, were done instead when you awake and they literally stretched you like the medieval torture. And that was very painful. And that pain stayed for a long time because the cast was much bigger than I. So it would pressure I had a machine in my mouth because the pressure was so strong underneath my chin and on my hips that my teeth could go back in my jaws. So I had a machine to keep my jaw separated. But still the pressure on the jaw was great. So it took days before my body gave in to that length.
I think what's so interesting about what you went through when you were young is that, you know, you, as an adult, you've been an internationally acclaimed beauty. And it must have been so odd for you to go from thinking of yourself as deformed to thinking of yourself as beautiful, or to realize other people thought of you as beautiful.
Yeah, that was kind of, it was wonderful. You know, I remember keep on sending postcards to my doctor saying, can you imagine? it was pretty wonderful to have overcome all the odds.
Was it important to you to be beautiful? Your mother was beautiful. You probably had a pretty insecure self-image when you were young because of the scoliosis and the surgery.
But not so much. You know, I think one thing is to do, I don't know, I can't really, I don't remember being young and wondering if I was beautiful or not beautiful and terribly concerned about that. I don't remember even in my old age being very concerned about it. I don't know if it is wisdom or if I'm spoiled. Maybe people did tell me, you look so pretty. So I thought, oh, well, then I don't have to worry about that. So I don't know. I don't remember it as being an obsession. When I had scoliosis, I didn't think of myself as ugly. I thought of myself as deformed, as having a deformed spine, which is different, you know, and trying to be well and trying to walk. I couldn't walk because I'd lost the ability to walk. The stake was so much higher than just look pretty.
Isabella Rossellini recorded in 1997. A special edition DVD of Blue Velvet will be released next Tuesday. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
She
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. By PBS, presenting Now with Bill Moyers, a new series that explores the issues shaping our world and changing our lives. Friday nights at 9 Eastern on PBS. Local times may vary. And National Geographic, featuring travel products including guidebooks, maps, magazines, and trips. Available in stores nationwide or online at nationalgeographic.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the director of Blue Velvet, Eraserhead, and Mulholland Drive, David Lynch, on the images that obsess him. Also, Ken Tucker reviews the third album by Eminem, and guest film critic Armand White reviews the new thriller about nuclear terrorism, The Sum of All Fears.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A special edition DVD of the 1986 film Blue Velvet is coming out next week. Film critic Owen Gleiberman of Entertainment Weekly described Blue Velvet as a masterpiece, arguably the real launching point of the new independent film movement. Director David Lynch fused the beauty and terror of dreams with the hypnotic storytelling excitement of a Hitchcock thriller. We're going to listen back to a 1994 interview with Lynch. He also made the films Eraserhead, The Elephant Man, Lost Highway, and Mulholland Drive, and the TV series Twin Peaks. Our interview was recorded after the publication of his book of photographs called Images. It included stills from his films, as well as other pictures that cataloged his visual obsessions. One chapter, called Organic Phenomenon, included a photo taken in a hospital basement of a cabinet with drawers marked amputated foot, gangrene, and kidney. There was also a photograph of a facial sore and another of a decapitated head from his film Eraserhead. I asked if there were body images or aspects of the body that disturbed him when he was young.
Since we're inside a body, there's a yearning to look at them and know them. And they exist in many shapes and forms, and they have such interesting textures. I think there's a lot to learn, like about proportion and repetition of shapes. A painting that works obeys certain rules, and those rules are at work in the way the body is put together as well.
Well, I want to connect this organic phenomena section of your book, Images, to the first movie that was actually theatrically released, Eraserhead, which really is one of the most unappetizing movies ever made, I think. The story is... What's that?
I don't know about that.
The story is about Henry, who gets his girlfriend pregnant, and their baby is this kind of braying creature. And I just want to play the scene where his girlfriend's mother corners Henry to see if he's the father and if he's been having sex with the daughter.
Henry, I asked you if you and Mary had sexual intercourse.
Well, I don't think that's any of your business.
Henry!
Sorry.
You're in very bad trouble if you won't cooperate.
Well, I... Mary?
Mother! Answer me.
I'm too nervous.
There's a baby. It's at the hospital.
Mom!
And you're the father.
But that's impossible. It's only... Mother,
they're still not sure it is a baby.
It's premature, but there's a baby.
Well, I think you were already a father when you made this movie. Was fatherhood disturbing to you?
Yes, it was.
What was disturbing about it?
Well, I was studying to be a painter and very keen on living the art life. And in the art life, the way I saw it then, it didn't have room for, a family life.
I'm wondering if the idea of a crying infant was almost incomprehensible to you, if you felt so far away from understanding an infant, if it seemed like a creature or an animal to you.
Well, Eraserhead's about, a couple of different things. And one of the things it's about is a family, but it could also be about other things. So I really love abstractions and things that maybe could be interpreted in different ways. So I don't really like to talk about the meaning so much. It's open for interpretation.
Eraserhead was your first theatrical released movie, and it became a midnight movie classic. Did you know anything about how to market a film? Did you know how to represent yourself to the film industry?
No, I knew nothing about... When I started making films, I knew nothing about film. And after Eraserhead was finished, after 5 years of working on it, I didn't know if anything would ever happen to the film, but Ben Barinholtz, who they call the grandfather of midnight films, he got Eraserhead for his company Libra Films, and he told me, he said, "David, we're not going to spend one nickel on this picture. We're just going to open it in a theater and let it sit there. And this is a word-of-mouth picture." And he said, "If we hold on long enough, you know, one day the theater will be full." And that's exactly what happened. And those were the times when there were many theaters that had midnight shows. And it was beautiful because these were films that in today's world would, you know, come and go when something's allowed to only, you know, work or fail in 1 week's time. And so you'd see on the marquee Eraserhead year after year, and eventually you'd want to go see it.
My guest is film director David Lynch. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1994 interview with David Lynch, director of the films Eraserhead, The Elephant Man, Mulholland Drive, and Blue Velvet, which will be released on a special edition DVD next week.
Now, I want to talk to you about urban landscapes, which is another theme that runs through your new book, Images, and through several of your films.
Right.
In Eraserhead, for instance, there's always something dripping or rumbling in the background. I mean, the whole film is set against this grimy, abandoned urban decay. There seems to be two types of places that interest you most. One is the small, overtly cheerful, all-American town like Lumberton and Blue Velvet or like Twin Peaks. And the other is the decaying, abandoned industrial landscape like in Eraserhead. But even in Blue Velvet, the evil happens in the more urban part of town. You've actually lived in both locations, haven't you?
Right. You know, where you are now, Philadelphia is, I always say that Eraserhead is, you know, my Philadelphia story. And I came from smaller places in the Northwest. You know, I grew up there till I didn't move to the East Coast till I was 15. And when you come from someplace like that and see a place like Philadelphia or, you know, Brooklyn, New York, it has an impact, and it completely fascinated me. And I used to go around in Philadelphia and feel this strangeness, and it was so powerful and fantastic. It really did something to me.
Your interest in industrial settings, you know, urban decay. I mean, it's so apparent in a couple of your movies, Eraserhead, but also in Elephant Man. Elephant Man is set in the early days of industrialization in England, when there's just like soot and grime all over the city.
Right.
And could you talk a little bit about what kind of effect you wanted the city to have in Elephant Man? What kind of visceral effect you wanted it to have on the viewers?
Well, it was because it was the Industrial Revolution going on at that time, and because the Elephant Man, you know, looked the way he looked, he was almost like a product of that. And and since I'm fascinated with smoke and fire and industry and all the things that happen in factories, it was just an opportunity, you know, at every point I could in the film to, you know, put something like that in. And that Mount St. Helena's eruption, when you see close-ups of the eruption, the smoke. The curls of the smoke, or like the curls of the smoke in an atomic bomb, look very much like the growths on the Elephant Man's body. There's something, there's some connection of the way a growth grows. It's just a slow motion version of an explosion, sort of. And I was, you know, these textures and the sounds and all these things seemed right for that world that the Elephant Man came from.
Now, I have to ask you a couple of questions about Blue Velvet.
Okay.
Was there something in particular that inspired the story?
Not really. The first two or three ideas were a neighborhood, kind of a green lawns with shadows, like lit at night from a light bulb, and red lips, and the color blue. And the song Blue Velvet, Bobby Vinton's version, influenced it a lot.
I've always wondered how you managed to take a Bobby Vinton record and turn it into a song about sexual fetishism.
Well, it's all in the lyrics there.
You think? Yeah,
oh,
I guess. Yeah. Did you hear it that way when you were young?
No. You know, sometimes the timing has to be correct. You hear something for years and nothing happens, and then one day you hear it connected with some other thought that may be happening, and something magical happens.
I just have one other body kind of question for you.
Okay.
And this is about the ear in Blue Velvet. In your film Blue Velvet, the plot is set in motion when Kyle MacLachlan discovers a decapitated ear in the grass. What makes this especially disturbing is not only the ants crawling through the ear, but also that some of the hair is still attached to the ear. Could you talk at all about how that image came to you?
Well, I don't know exactly how it came, but it, Jeffrey, the ear is like a canal. It's like an opening, a little egress into another place. And it seemed like a perfect, it's like a ticket to another world that he finds. And, I mean, if he hadn't found it, you know, he would have kept on going home, and that would have been the end of it. But the fascination with this, once found, drew him into something that he needed to discover and work through.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us about your work.
Well, thank you for talking to me.
Director David Lynch recorded in 1994. His 1986 film Blue Velvet will be released on a special edition DVD next week. Eminem's CD, the Marshall Mathers LP, was the most controversial pop album of the year 2000. Praised for its verbal invention, condemned for its misogyny and homophobia, it polarized generations of rap music fans while selling millions and creating the most prominent white star ever within this primarily black music form. Now 27-year-old Marshall Mathers is back with his third album, The Eminem Show. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review.
I've created a monster, cause nobody wants to see Marshall no more. They want Shady, I'm chopped liver. Well, if you want Shady, this is what I'll give you. A little bit of weed mixed with some hard liquor, some vodka that'll jumpstart my heart quicker than a shock when I get shocked at the hospital by the doctor when I'm not cooperating, when I'm rocking the table while he's operating. Hey! You waited this long to stop debating, cause I'm back, I'm on the rag and ovulating. I know that you got a job, Miss Cheney, but your husband's heart problem's complicating. So the FCC won't let me be.
On The Eminem Show, our protagonist, the ceaselessly angry, bitter Eminem, who also calls himself Slim Shady, once again locates himself at the center of the universe. All around him, he finds enemies, betrayal, and mean-spirited critics intent on burying poor little M. He inflates the importance of certain events. The duet he performed last year with one of his more famous fans, Elton John, at an MTV stage event is referred to as playing career Russian roulette, as if that pairing wasn't really just shrewd, audience-expanding self-promotion for both of them. Eminem yells obscenities at Tipper Gore, mother of the warning label sticker, and a Target so passé you wonder if M's ever heard of Twisted Sister or Frank Zappa. You about to witness hip-hop in its most purest, most rawest form, flow almost flawless, most hardest, most honest, known artist. Chip off the old block, but old Doc is back. Looks like Batman brought his own Robin. Oh God, but Don's got his own Laden. With his own private plane, his own pilot. Set the blow college, dorm room doors off the hinges. Oranges, peach, pears, plums, syringes. Yeah, here I come, I'm inches away from you, dear, fear none. Hip-hop is in a state of 911, so let's get down. Eminem calls himself a pit bull off his leash and the boogie monster of rap with a plan to ambush this Bush administration. Something typically vague about, quote, pushing this generation of kids to stand and fight for the right to say something you might not like. Now there's an original bit of rebelliousness, eh? Still, you have to like Eminem's occasional glimpses of humor, as when he addresses, quote, white America, and uses as proof of his political influence the hugs he receives when he appears on MTV's afternoon music countdown show, TRL. Over the course of the Eminem show, he picks up a bit of autobiography from his previous albums about how much his mommy never liked him. Indeed, his mother felt so slandered by the Marshall Mathers LP that she sued him and recorded her own rap answer record to his charges. He has the gall to call himself a soldier whose shoulders hold up so much, and then whines about being arrested for possessing a concealed weapon. He badmouths his wife Kim again. He fantasized at great length about murdering her on his last album. But here he makes a sad little attempt at singing in a tune to his young daughter, Haley. My baby girl, keeps getting older. I watch her grow up with pride. People make jokes. Don't see my real side. I act like shit, don't face me. Inside it drives me crazy. My insecurities could eat me alive. But then I see my baby. Suddenly I'm not crazy. It all makes sense when I look into her eyes. Oh no. You'll notice that after a scant two lines about his daughter, Eminem immediately reverts to himself again, moaning with self-pity about how people, quote, don't understand me, they just don't see my real side. Gee, except for the rhythms and the beats, he's just one step away from being a 70s confessional singer-songwriter, impure early period James Taylor. Well, when all you present are two facets of your personality, what he calls in that song a pistol-packing drug addict who bags on his mama, and the sensitive soul complaining about how you're perceived, you just come off like a chump. Eminem has a real knack for writing rhyming couplets and using his white skin as access to a wider audience than most black rappers can dream of, but he remains a jerk. On the first single off this album, he refers to himself as, quote, the worst thing since Elvis Presley to use black music to get myself wealthy. Eminem as Elvis? About the only thing they have in common is that their names begin with the letter E. And I'm no stickler for authenticity in art. I think part of being creative is making things up. But Eminem is downright maniacal about being viewed as authentic. So it behooves me to point out to the erstwhile Marshall Mathers that Elvis was Presley's real name.
Ken Tucker is critic-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed The Eminem Show. Coming up, guest film critic Armand White reviews the new thriller about nuclear terrorism, The Sum of All Fears. This is Fresh Air. The Sum of All Fears is a new thriller about nuclear terrorism adapted from the Tom Clancy novel of the same name. The movie stars Ben Affleck as a young Jack Ryan at the beginning of his career in the CIA. Guest film critic Armand White has a review.
Sequelitis, Hollywood's Law of Diminishing Returns, is upon us again with The Sum of All Fears, the fourth movie version of those Tom Clancy novels about CIA analyst Jack Ryan. The series started with Alec Baldwin in the Ryan role. Then Harrison Ford took over the next two. Each film made Ryan a more solid and serious guy. Now, to accommodate Ben Affleck and his Pearl Harbor boyishness, The Sum of All Fears offers what can be called an alternate universe prequel. This Jack Ryan is younger than ever, at the start of his career, yet the political events alluded to are contemporary. You could say the story is ripped from tomorrow's headlines. Ryan uncovers a terrorist plot to explode a bomb on U.S. turf. But the plot's also a ripoff from other action-adventure movies and TV shows. It's an embarrassingly adolescent view of how international intrigue works. Affleck's Ryan gets recruited by CIA Director Cabot. That's the role originated by James Earl Jones and now played by Morgan Freeman. With Cabot as his mentor, Ryan goes from Pentagon researcher to globe-trotting investigator because Cabot trusts his expertise on Russian politics. In post-Cold War movies, the Ruskies are always the first suspect until a slicker enemy can be found. The Sum of All Fears compounds our international fears about who's got the bomb by making the Russians, along with assorted quasi-Middle Eastern terrorists, the objects of U.S. anxiety.
Are you advocating we launch a first strike?
It is not a first strike. There's already been a first strike and a second. Don't you get it?
No, I don't get it. I don't understand why we have to nuke them, for God's sake. It's not reasonable.
Get it. Get it. They practically sank an aircraft carrier. Our missile silos are hot. We're getting nothing but bolt from Nemirov. And let's not forget how this thing started, okay? They tried to kill me, remember? So don't you tell me to be reasonable.
Now that's not exactly the stuff of breath-baiting suspense. It's more like pop political mockery. The actors you just heard, Ron Rifkin, Bruce McGill, James Cromwell, and Philip Baker Hall, put on their worried white men frowns while playing the U.S. president and his key advisors. This very familiar Corridors of Power stuff isn't sober and tense like Kevin Costner's 13 Days. It's meant to be fun. And though Phil Alden Robinson, the director of Field of Dreams, here orchestrates a Field of Dread, he doesn't satirize nuclear anxiety or military craziness like Kubrick's Dr. Strangelove did. Instead, The Sum of All Fears boasts a teenage jokester's worst-case scenario. Alan Bates plays the neo-Nazi whose dirty bomb is smuggled into the U.S., and detonated to kill the president during his visit to a sports arena. Awesome, dude. After 9/11, the attempt to make entertainment out of terrorist threats has a Mad Magazine madness. No matter how grim, and despite Clancy's reputation, this isn't really adult entertainment. Jack Ryan is a policy wonk Walter Mitty who dreams of James Bond daring. More so than in the previous Clancy films, Affleck's Ryan is just a mind-reading CIA pup. His youth and frisky optimism enable him to intuit the thinking of Russia's new president Nemirov, who was played by gothic romantic Irish actor Karen Hines. That's a handy skill which sets up the film's hands-on-the-button climax. But we're a long way from the thoughtful, truly adult political dissatisfaction that Harrison Ford and director Philip Noyce brought to the previous sequel, Clear and Present Danger. Clear and Present Danger was the best of the Ryan flicks because it activated the audience's sense of political ethics and it had the series' only memorable moment.
You mind if I give you a bit of advice? Of course, you know this because you're a smart guy. You should never make important decisions while you're upset.
You did. And American soldiers and innocent civilians are dead because of it.
I never ordered any...
No, don't even think about playing that game with me. I will not let you dishonor their memories by pretending you had nothing to do with it.
How dare you come in here and lecture me?
How dare you, sir?
How dare the makers of this movie presume to tackle the sum of all our fears, but do so with a comic book, adventure serial, daydreaming, nightmarish insensitivity? The relationship between Ryan and Cabot has none of the world-weary credibility that made Sam Peckinpah's espionage movies adult and memorable. Because Robinson runs completely out of ideas, he recycles movie cliches. That's a trite resolution of post-9/11 paranoia. Once the CIA determines who the bomb welders are, Robinson rips off The Godfather. He stages a killing spree finale timed to Puccini's Nessun Dorma. It's final proof these filmmakers aren't serious or grown up at all. Just shameless.
Armand White is film critic for the New York Press. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. WHYY's director of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the history behind one of the most contested issues in the Middle East, the Israeli settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.